session number 27185, reel 43.
Major Barras, reel 43. You were saying that these exercises were to practice section and platoon commanders.
Initially, yes, first training. It occurred to me that when I was up in the hills with my company, of course we had field firing ranges there and target ranges as well, which we had, not us, but the garrison had put up some time before we got constructed, before we got there.
Yes.
But you had a fairly free hand as to what you did whilst we were up in the hills, for instance. I mean, I used live ammunition up there to demonstrate something I wanted to show. I was always very keen on what I called the crack-thump situation, because I don't think people have thought about it too clearly. When a bullet's coming your way, it cracks in the air. But when it leaves the gun the other end, it thumps. So I've tried to teach them to ignore the crack, not if they can. if it doesn't crack, it's going to hit you. And to listen and try and pinpoint the thump, because that's where the enemy were. And I did this up in the hills. I got senior, I think I sergeant major, with a Bren gun over in the hills opposite. And wireless communication and so forth, whilst our guys all sat round this side in slit trenches. And he fired, he moved around over there without being seen, and fired single shots across, not at us, but near us. I don't know where the bullets landed, actually, but I think I was, I was careful enough to ensure they didn't land in the middle of Salonika. And then it was up to, I'd ask one or two of the soldiers if they could locate where it was. So we were able to do things like that, which we could never have done in this country, for instance.
Sounds much more realistic.
Yes, yeah. And then, of course, we worked, as I said, up into company exercises and battalion exercises, which were set by brigade. And then he would, the brigadier would come and issue, well, he'd come and talk to us afterwards and say what he thought went wrong or went right. And then he would issue a whole report on it afterwards, sent down to us, of what ought to be done to put things right next time if things went wrong.
Said you were in hills. Did this make any difference to the tactics you were using? Was the terrain?
Well, there were flat bits as well.
There were flat bits.
But outside Salonika, it was flat. But the nearer you got to the border, the more hilly it became. So you couldn't go more than a few miles without sort of bumping into the odd hills here and there. But I don't think it... I don't think so, no. I mean, we didn't try and attack mountains. There were big mountains behind. One was called Cortiatus or something like that, I remember. It disappeared in its summit. It used to disappear in the clouds during the day. Which reminds me, one of the first things I did on becoming adjutant was to abolish the 5:30 a.m. PT parade, which I thought was more of a cosmetic feeling of aren't we doing the right thing sort of thing, which I thought was wrong, because we all went out there at 5:30, and afterwards everybody went back and lay on their beds waiting for breakfast.
What time was breakfast?
Oh, I didn't come up till about 8 o'clock. But I was just coming back to mountains, because the only rewarding thing about getting up at that time of the day, at that time of the year, which we're now still talking about April or May, was to look across the sea and see 50 miles away the peak of Mount Olympus, who snow-capped summit, pink in the early sunrise. And that was some sight. And it's difficult to imagine it being 50 miles an hour, but it just poked over the horizon. But that was the only thing worth going out to do, as far as I was concerned. But you see, PT could be fitted in during the day. We had an APTC instructor who took physical exercise training and so forth. So he was the guy to get his program going later in the day. As it got warmer, of course, we were in battle dress now. As it got warmer, we went into KD, khaki shorts. And they weren't thin shirts, they were sort of more woolen sort of shirts, dark khaki. We wore stockings with the what was called the Wasp Flash, which was the yellow and black colours of the Bedfords down the side of the stocking. In fact, their magazine is called the Wasp.
How did the Colonel actually run the battalion? Did he run it on paper or did he run it on a verbal basis?
Well, as I say, he was very supportive as far as I was concerned, and he used to leave quite a bit. He didn't interfere. He used to make quite clear what his intentions were. And then left it to me. Now, very often I would have to phone round people and tell them what was required. But mind you, there was daily orders that had to be got out and sent round to battalion, to companies. But very often he'd have a conference and bring the company commanders, quartermaster, RSM and so forth into it, or whoever it was necessary to have in. At the end of it, I would have to get out to make up the minutes of the meeting or action, and then ensure that whatever was in the minutes was carried out. It was up to me to ensure that the action was done.
But did you normally issue extensive written orders
No.
before exercises?
No. Oh, before exercise?
Yes.
Oh, yes. You had to issue a battalion exercise, yes. I mean, you had to set the scene as to why we were going out on the exercise. First you had to give the background as to sort of thing like the Mediterranean doesn't exist or
yes,
whatever.
The narrative.
That's right. Yes. And that we're at war with whoever it is and the yes. battalion's been set this task, so forth. And then you get out the order of getting them on the move. Order of march, different groups, commands and so forth. Operation order, in fact.
Once you got into the field, once you're on exercise, were orders given verbally or in writing?
Both. Yeah. It's rather like we were in Normandy or in Europe, actually. The CO would always give out verbal orders. I mean, you never sent out written orders. Start first when you had an operation of that sort. The CA would always have his company commanders and anybody involved, maybe the mortar platoon commander and the anti-tank platoon commander, and give out his orders verbally. Now, if time permitted, they were followed up by written orders, which is the old duplicating machine was working, someone turning the handle and, you know, the old duplicating machine, and then get those sent out. And then you always put at the top of the orders, no change from verbal orders, so that the people who got them knew that this was merely what the CO had in fact given, had said.
Confirmation.
It was confirmation of what he'd said.
Had there been any changes of any significance by that time from your procedures during the war in terms of
No, I don't think so. It was more or less what we'd learnt at the Staff College, because I found my staff training and staff jobs I'd held very useful as adjutant. The other thing I found useful was, of course, I'd been battalion IO in 1940. And also, I was acting as assistant adjutant then, when the adjutant went off. I sat in as little adjutant for him when he was away. So I was able to sort of slip into the job more or less. Now there, of course, I was now upholding the traditions of the Bedfords, which was a little bit different, of course.
And what about the tactics? Have there been any changes of note in the tactics?
Not really. No, I don't think so. The organisation of the battalion was very much the same.
And the weaponry?
The weaponry was still, I think we still, we noticed that was the same.
You still had the Bren, didn't you?
We still had the Bren, we still had the number 4 rifle with the little sort of meat skewer on the end, which was passed for a bayonet. The carrier platoon was there. I can't remember, we must have had end. I don't know whether we had tank guns there or not, but if we did, they would have been 6-pounders. The assault pioneer platoon, mortars, 3-inch mortars still. Strangely enough, of course, the organisation hasn't changed very much today, has it? I mean, the fire company, or whatever they call support company, has got different weapons in it, and we got different radio, and there's much more sort of done on computerised stuff, but the actual basic organisation hasn't changed very much, and that's 50 years ago.
More than 50 years now.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. let's see, what else can we say? Of course, I used to, a lot of my duties were things like courts of inquiry, courts martial. I had to put together and nominate people. I was basically, as an adjutant, you're basically responsible for the overall discipline and administration of the battalion on behalf of the CO. And of course, you used to have orders, battalion order room orders used to come up once a day, where individuals who'd done something wrong, put on a charge, seen by their company commander, who didn't have the powers to deal with it because he could only give 7 days CB and thought he merited something. This, the convict or the what's the word I want?
Defaulter.
No, the accused.
The accused.
Yes, he's now the accused. He's not. We've got to be very careful. He's now the accused. Had done something which merited a higher punishment, which the CO had the powers to impose. He would be remanded for the commanding officer's orders. And I had to collect all this in, get all the information in through the RSM. And what was called the 214s, I think the army form was, the charge sheet.
Yes.
You get all those made out. And you had to be very careful to get the charge right. It had to be in order of what was in the Army Act or the King's Regulations, as it was that time. Which reminds me of how you can go wrong. Of a story I heard, which was perfectly true, I'm told, of a warrant officer who was, must have been the company sergeant major, walking around during parade hours, seeing if he could find any sort of skivers anywhere, went into the latrines, as they were called, found one door closed, kicked it, and said, "Who's in there?" And a voice said, "Archbishop of Canterbury." So he put him on a charge, and when he got him into the up to the CO's orderly room, he said, he'd giving his evidence. He said, "Put the accused on a charge for stating a falsehood to the warrant officer. In that he did say he was the Archbishop of Canterbury, knowing full well that was not the case." Now, obviously, he put him on a charge for stating falsehood when he should have put him on for insolence.
Yeah.
So he got off. I don't know whether he was recharged or what. So we had to be very careful as to getting the charge framed correctly.
Now you were saying that discipline was maintained despite
yes.
the lack of active enthusiasm at
yeah.
the end of term.
Yeah.
What sort of offences were being committed in the battalion?
Do you know, I can't remember. I can't remember anything particularly bad happening. I suppose they were just the usual things. I mean, soldiers could go off down the town and have too much to drink. They could neglect their equipment to some extent. Worse, they could neglect their rifle or Bren gun, which was almost a court-martial offence. They could disobey an order. But they were fairly trivial. I don't recall anything outstanding happening there. Nobody committing a murder or going off, and it was very difficult for them to go absent there without leave, because there was nowhere for them to go.
You mentioned organising court-martials. Do you know what any of them were about?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, it wasn't our own court-martial I had to organise. I mean, I was told by brigade to nominate not the chairman, was the president or members of a court-martial. And so I had to nominate somebody. But if we had our own... I don't recollect us having a court-martial. We had several courts of inquiry, but they were... It could have been an accident. Somebody could have had an accident.
Convening a board of officers, then?
Yes, that's right, the board of officers, which I had to do, stating why was a court of inquiry and what their object was, and then getting the papers back and going through them and recommending to the CO any action that's required.
In terms of reference?
In terms, yeah. Following the court of inquiry. Mm. As to whether any further action was required, or whether what was in the Court of Inquiry proceedings was correct. We all had to check that out. And of course, I had a very good order and quartermaster sergeant, Brace, he was at that time. He went home later, and of course, this other guy who I mentioned earlier took over from him. He was then a sergeant. He hadn't been promoted to OR Commiss. He said he preferred a Bedford.
Dedicated Bedford.
Yes, that's right, yes. I used to go... I mean, I was responsible for the drums. The adjutant's responsible for the drums. That's what came under his command. And the band I got involved with. I insisted upon getting involved with the band because I felt that the band... I always felt that the colours were the soul of the regiment and the band was the heart of the regiment. And the band makes a lot of difference to the regiment when it's out on parade or playing. And I was very distressed when they started taking bands away from battalions. Mind you, you've got to have a properly organised, orchestrated band. It's no use having half a band because it sounds awful.
Yes.
I know at one stage they reduced them to something like 20-odd. Well, a band's got to be over 30 at least. I believe the Guards bands were in London are 60.
They survived.
Yes, they survived because they're public duties.
Yes.
But now, of course, I know the Royal Anglians have got the Normandy band, and I think that's up to strength. I mean, at least they can keep one band up to strength. But the battalions have got their drums. And I was responsible for for keeping the drums up to strength. Of course, the drums weren't musicians like the band. They were recruited from the ordinary infantry companies and then could be returned to duty and changed over. The problem there is you had to start training them again, but there was a turnover, and they played the bugle and the fife and the drum, and I ensured they were kept up to strength and got plenty of practice.
Were you enough volunteers? Were you detailing people?
I can't remember now. I don't think we had any problem. They were always up to strength. I think they considered it rather an honour to be... to be in the drums. You were special, as opposed to just being number 16 in infantry platoon.
Make a change too.
Makes a change entirely. Yeah.
What happened to you when you came back from Greece? How was that done? Were you relieved in place, or did you simply?
No, we weren't relieved. We came out. In fact, the Suffolk had gone. I can't remember. I don't know whether the 43rd went before us. I remember I had a very good relationship with their adjutant, Mike Harbottle, who became a general later summer. The only thing that happened there was he got a dog which got rabies, which I used to stroke. He used to lick my hand, I remember. So I was sent off to the medics to have the anti-rabies inoculations, which went on every day for 2 weeks, I think, in the stomach. most unpleasant, but not as unpleasant as getting rabies. So I think we were the last ones to leave. I remember that we had a farewell parade, and this was in April. So we'd been there, or was it, no, wait a minute, it was a little bit before April, because it was bitterly cold. It was must have been February of 50. And we had a farewell parade in Salonika, and we got the freedom of the city, I remember. So we marched through with bayonets fixed and drums playing, and we went to the main square, where we formed up as a battalion, waiting for a Greek general to arrive. And of course he was late, and it was so cold. And the first thing we had to do was to give him a present arms, general salute, present arms. Then we had to do an advance and review order, which I don't know whether you're aware of, but you march forward to the tune of the grenadiers, 12 paces, and halt, and then the music cut, first 12 bars. So everybody had to count 12 and then stop, and you all had to halt at the same time. So we'd done a lot of practice on this, because you could hear almost people around you sort of counting under their breath as we went forward. But when we got the order to advance, I couldn't feel my feet. I can remember I thought I must have left them behind somewhere. It was so cold. But that was our last parade there. And as I say, we weren't relieved. And I can't remember the troop ship we came back in, but we embarked and came home. I remember sailing through the Aegean Sea with the sun, sort of golden sunlight coming through the mist. And all you could see was the sort of misty outlines of islands round about. It was rather enchanting going through there. Other than that, I can't remember very much going home. We had to keep the troops occupied, of course, we were having a battalion on board. So they had to do weapon training and PT and stuff round the decks. We came home to Southampton. Can't remember where we called. I think we called at Port Said. Probably took more troops aboard there. We came to Southampton, and I remember before we arrived in Southampton, we had to be prepared for the customs, because apparently some battalion which had gone through before, customs had gone through them and found a lot of troops there had been rather stupid and had brought back a whole lot of stuff which they shouldn't have done.
What sort of stuff?
Well, cigarettes and booze and things like that, which were way over the allowance. They probably had all kinds of things they bought which they didn't declare. I don't know if it was many of them, but it was just enough for the customs to say, right, we're going through the whole battalion. Not us, the other battalion.
Yes.
So they, having found out one or two, they then got everybody down and emptied their kit bags, their haversacks and everything,
good
and went
lot.
Through it.
Mm.
Actually, they were quite kind to us, I remember, when we arrived there. It wasn't too bad. We went into the warehouse and we were off in the train before you could hardly any time at all. We then finished up and going in a sort of usual safari way of troop trains around southern England. We finished up in Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. And I can remember very well, we marched up from the station, which was a mistake, to the barracks, which were the other side of the town. And we had to march through the town. I don't know, we must have had a drums or band or something out. I'm not sure that we even had that. We still had our greatcoats on, because it was very cold still in UK, and we'd been sleeping in the train. And we looked, I must say, a straggly lot. And I wouldn't have done it, quite frankly, if I had put him in transport and sent them straight up. But then somebody insisted we march through the town. And I knew we didn't look our best. And as we were going through the town, I was up in front behind the CO at the head of the column. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Brigadier Henry Blessed. Now, he'd been my CO and Brigadier, you may remember, previously in the Essex Regiment. And now retired, living at Ruffham, just outside Bury St Edmunds. And I couldn't help thinking, I wonder what on earth he's thinking. Anyway, when we got to barracks, obviously later when we'd all spruced up, we used to beat retreat and have parades and things, and being a local celebrity, he was invited down, and I think he got a proper perspective of what the battalion was really like. He was very kind. He invited me to go and stay the weekend with him whilst I was there. I remember he brought me up tea in the morning, which I don't imagine many captains had brigadiers do, even retired. I stayed with his family there. It was Joan, his wife, who was the daughter of an ex-Essex Colonel Crocker. And he's her brother was Monty Crocker, who has also been a major in Essex. And they had a chicken he used to walk about called Mrs. Ackerdo, I remember. God, that's quite irrelevant there. Anyway. So when we got to Bury St Edmunds, we had to settle ourselves. And, of course, there'd been an advance party had gone ahead. And the second-in-command who'd come out to us in Greece was a chap called Jimmy Adams, who was a university entrant. It showed a bit. He wasn't as precise and clipped as those who've been in the regular army most of the time from their youngest days. Although he was efficient and a very likeable chap and had a very sort of dry sense of humour, he used to go off the mark a little when he was talking about things and wander around sort of coming straight to the point. But he knew his job, and he was, as a second in command would be, in charge of all training whilst he was there. But he'd been sent off as head of the advance party and prepared the way for us before we got there. So everything would be all set up. He'd take cooks with him, he'd take representatives from every company, so that all the barrack rooms were opened and ready for us. I'm not sure what happened to our heavy equipment, whether all our vehicles came home with us, or whether they were flogged off to the Greek army and we picked up new ones when we got here, in which case he would have had to have got around and seen where the local ordnance depots were for drawing equipment of that calibre. And of course he would have taken the quartermaster with him, or the RQMS, the regimental quartermaster sergeant. I don't know which way around they worked it, because you obviously needed somebody back with the battalion getting packed up, ready to go down to the troop ship. And that took a bit of organising too, because all the administration and liaising with the OC troops, because you didn't have an awful lot of time, because the ship came in, it was probably there for 2 days. And during that time, you had to get aboard the ship, see the OC troops, get all the allocation of decks and cabins, give him a list of people who had cabins, which were all the officers, warrant officers, and sergeants shared, I think, but then there was all the marrieds, because we had families out there as well. So that was always a big problem. So the quartermaster who remained behind, if it was a quartermaster or RQMS, I don't know, but I think it probably might have been the quartermaster, because all packing cases had to be made, crates and heaven knows what, for getting all the stuff
shipping.
In. Yeah, for shipping. And marked, so that there was a great big list, so we knew exactly what was in each crate, in a list with numbers on. So all that had to be done. So I can't remember. I can't remember whether our transport came back in another different ship, or whether we left it behind or we might have taken over the transport and heavy weapons left behind by the previous battalion, which had been stationed at Bury St Edmunds. Who I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know who they were, because they'd gone by the time I.